You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Tig Enright, and coming up on the programme, released on bail. Pakistan's former Prime Minister and his daughter are freed while they await an appeal to their convictions for corruption. What does it mean for Nawaz Sharif's replacement in high office? Also ahead, another battle of wills between the US and China, this time over Chinese state media's journalists in Washington and whether they should be classed as foreign agents. And a tall story from Moscow, the home of one of its most celebrated architects, which remained as his private property throughout the Soviet era.
There are many buildings around us. You see them, you go away, you forget about them, right? But not about this house. Believe me, whether you like it or not, you will never forget the forms, you will never forget the image.
We'll also have a review of Asia's morning papers and ask a very big question. If Hollywood's fantastical superheroes, androids and zombies are responsible for the character that is President Donald Trump. All that coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And where we start today is in Pakistan. A court there has ordered the release of the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and his daughter Mariam while they await the chance to appeal their convictions for corruption. Well, it was revelations in the Panama Papers about his alleged ownership of posh flats here in London that saw Nawaz Sharif forced from office by the Supreme Court. But the High Court today agreed with his defence team that there wasn't enough evidence of ownership and said that he and his daughter could leave prison while they prepared their appeal. Well, they emerge into a new Pakistan nearly 2 months after Sharif's party lost a general election to the party of the new Prime Minister, Imran Khan. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Samira Shackle, who's a journalist and writer with a focus on the Indian subcontinent. Welcome, Samira. At the time of Sharif's ousting, supporters said it was a stitch up by the military. What do you think this decision says about that theory?
I think it definitely kind of backs it up. So the Nawaz Sharif was ousted last year, as you said, over the Panama Papers. He was then, he and his daughter, put in prison about 2 weeks, if that, before the election took place on the 25th of July. And that was kind of broadly seen as a way to get him out of the way, basically. So he was his party was the incumbent party. And although he'd been barred from running for public office when he was ousted, he was still sort of leading the party. He was really criticising the military's attempt to expand its role in public life and its all existing kind of hold over public life. And so for him to now be released...
Jailing a former PM 2 weeks ahead of an election, I mean, I guess some might say it was an attempt to silence him. You could also be a rallying call to his supporters that, you know, this was a stitch-up.
Absolutely. So I think that definitely was the case. His arrest... came alongside a whole host of other measures, including in the days before his arrest, 500 or so party workers and activists were rounded up and arrested, and that was to prevent a kind of big rally to greet him and his daughter as they were taken to jail. And I think it certainly has added fuel to the idea that they want him out of the way. You've seen that already today. Various members of the party have been saying, you know, this shows it was a stitch up. There was insufficient evidence. And actually, you know, to an extent, this is backed up by the EU official monitoring mission of the Pakistani election, which said in the weeks after the election that it hadn't been a level playing field and that the level of political pressure and media censorship around Nawaz Sharif's party meant that it wasn't a fair contest.
What's your analysis as to how likely he is to win this appeal? I know you're not a lawyer or a judge, but what's your sense?
It's very, very difficult to say. The kind of what the legal experts are saying is that the suspension of this sentence, because it is a suspension, probably means it will lead to an acquittal, because the judges in the High Court did explicitly say that there hadn't been enough evidence to tie Nawaz Sharif to these flats that he was ousted over, so that the evidence was insufficient. The question mark is over the two other charges which are still pending over him. So I don't think Nawaz Sharif is definitely off the hook. But his daughter, Mariam Nawaz, who's his kind of political heir apparent, this was the only charge against her. So if those predictions are correct and it does end in an acquittal, then she's free to kind of lead the party and take her place as his heir.
If it was a stitch-up, you know, you could argue it's mission accomplished because there's no longer his party's no longer in power. What do you, you know, see about the likelihood of Mariam ultimately taking over once more?
I think that there's a good chance she'll take over leadership of the party. She's, I think, quite popular amongst the party base. This is, you know, as a party that's won multiple elections and is still the main opposition in the country. And I think also, although obviously there's no chance of the party, the PMLN, immediately kind of seizing power again, they really can create a lot of ruckus from the sidelines, you know, which ironically Imran Khan's party in the last, period in government last time, Imran Khan's party raised hell and made it very, very difficult to govern. He was constantly calling protests and so on and protesting from the sidelines. So I think that could be done easily, as we've seen.
What kind of headache does Imran Khan have now?
Well, I think that's the risk, really, is this is the idea that they could be protesting that the election result was rigged. They could be, kind of questioning whether he's in the pocket of the military, which is already quite a widespread assertion after the election and the way that was conducted. So I think there's that, and there's also the question of kind of political disunity and so on, which is a big issue for Pakistan.
Corruption is one of Khan's rallying calls. He said he was going to clean it up. I suppose most politicians do say that. Mm-hmm. Has he got anything? Is there anything he could do to actually make life difficult, more difficult for the Sharifs now that they're out? Is there any kind of regulations, laws he could put in place that might throw more obstructions in their way?
Well, I think in terms of the Sharifs specifically, there still are corruption charges pending against Nawaz Sharif, obviously. And there's also the spectre of some corruption charges against other members of his party. Some analysts have warned against Khan pursuing that too enthusiastically because the kind of optics of pursuing opposition politicians on corruption charges, particularly when corruption is known to be so widespread, I think is not great, particularly when the country is seeking an IMF bailout and those kinds of signs of intense domestic disharmony are not great. But, you know, there's a whole host of measures. If he came in on an anti-corruption platform, that's what his appeal is to a lot of people. And so I think any measures that target the kind of super rich industrialists, which is the category the Sharifs are drawn from, certainly wouldn't be great for them.
What does it say about the overall state of corruption in Pakistan and efforts to rein it in?
Well, corruption is so widespread and endemic, and so it's quite difficult to see where Imran Khan would start. And I think part of the reason that the corruption charges against the Sharifs and some of their kind of coterie of close allies, part of the reason that's been seen as politically motivated is just that corruption really is so widespread. And part of the way that Imran Khan won was by co-opting into his party what he called electables, who are prominent members of other parties who brought with them kind of existing voter banks. And many of these so-called electables are entirely implicated in the corrupt political system which he claimed to want to displace, and none of those people are facing corruption charges. So I think that doesn't look great, doesn't leave a great taste in the mouth. There's a huge, huge amount to be done on corruption.
Talking of taste in mouths, what's your sense as to the appetite, the genuine appetite among Pakistani voters for a genuine clampdown on corruption? Because I suppose, you know, corruption is one thing when it's the opposing side, but it's quite another thing. It can be seen quite differently, allegations of corruption, when it's among the party that you back.
Well, there's a few things there for sure. I mean, I think one of the problems now is that this is seen as a kind of, certainly among sections of society, as a politically motivated thing and a way to kind of get at opponents, and that's because of the kind of unequal way that these cases have been pursued. But of course, both things can be true. You can have a trial that wasn't really a fair trial, and the person can be corrupt. You know, that doesn't one doesn't necessarily negate the other. I think amongst many of the kind of upwardly mobile young middle class people who voted for Imran Khan, you know, the reality of corruption makes their lives a misery, and they would really, really like to see genuine change. The difficulty is that the kind of elite classes, many of whom are the political power brokers and business owners, would fight it tooth and nail and really don't want to see it at all.
OK. Samira Shackle, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. You are listening to Monocle 24. Listening to the Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. I'm Tighe Enright. Now, today was the day that the US pushed China a bit farther away, imposing a new wave of trade tariffs and their increasingly bitter trade war, and undoing much of the ever so slowly improving relations between them. But while the business world gets hot under the collar about barriers to trade, a story about journalism has been less widely reported, with Washington planning to force some Chinese state media organizations based in the US to register as foreign agents. Well, Sam Gill is executive editor of China Dialogue and also an associate fellow at Chatham House and joins me now in studio to analyse. Welcome, Sam, to the programme. What difference would this make to those organisations and their journalists operating in Washington? How would it affect their ability to do their jobs?
It wouldn't affect them very significantly. It affects the perception of those outlets. It probably will affect the perception of those outlets among the foreign employees, of which there are many, particularly for CGTN. So the outlets they're targeting are Xinhua News Agency, which is China's oldest news agency. It used to be called Red China News Agency. It actually predates the People's Republic of China and was founded in the 1930s as the Communist Party agency. And CGTN, which is the sort of cutting edge of Chinese media power. It's the rebranding of CCTV, Global TV Network. And it has a lot of foreign employees in Washington and its other bureaus. So the idea that they would now become foreign agents, I think, will affect their perception. And it probably will affect, for example, their ability to get access to film US Congress, for example, which is what happened with RT, for which this was really the precedent.
Yeah, the precedent, as you say, has been set by the treatment of journalists working for those Russian outlets, RT and Sputnik, you know, in many ways deemed as propagandists and in many people's eyes, rightly so. I mean, while Chinese state media will obviously always say quite nice things about China and its leadership, what it doesn't do, unlike the likes of RT, is try to make serious mischief and stir conspiracy theories in the way that the Russians do. Do you think it's fair to put them on a par with each other?
I think it's a different strategy. You're right to say that Chinese influence operations or soft power push, you might call it, doesn't have that characteristic of being characterized by sort of disinformation campaigns and so on. But I do think it's difficult to see something like Xinhua or indeed China Daily and People's Daily, which I think are already registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or CGTN as being journalism other than as opposed to propaganda. They are very tightly controlled. They're very directly the throat and tongue of the Chinese Communist Party. Not actually the state so much as specifically the party, and they follow the line in such a way that is, it's a very different model of journalism, one might say.
So we have been told that there has been a meeting between Chinese and American officials to discuss this, with obviously Beijing hoping that Washington will back down. What do you think will happen?
I think a big part of this is not the wider trade tensions and so on, although clearly that's part of the backdrop, but actually specifically the question of reciprocity around the increasing lack or decreasing realm of access for US media operating in China. There's been a big pushback against the international media's operations within China, visa refusals, detentions of journalists, just the general sense that the atmosphere for US media is worsening.
So one of the things we've been hearing, a bit like the trade war, is that China would retaliate if the US goes through with this. But what you're saying is that actually this is a US retaliation in many ways, because China's been making it harder for Western journalists.
There's a ratcheting on both sides. kids. And part of the pretext for this, I think, is that there has been, and you know, they're right to, the US are right to point to this, there has been an increasing restriction on the access of foreign journalists in China covering covering sensitive stories, particularly human rights stories and so on, but more widely. The other thing I think they are right to point to is the extent to which we've maybe underrepresented or to this point not been as aware of the degree to which Chinese influence operations are actually very widespread in the United States. While they don't have that same characteristic, as you say, of being mischievous and characterized by disinformation and direct political interference, there is nevertheless an increasing extent to which the Chinese Communist Party is shaping the message and very actively, aggressively
doing?
Shaping the message. Well, one of the most notable but underreported aspects is the extent to which they are buying time and space within Western publications to print propaganda effectively. So papers like the Washington Post, a number of other prominent papers now carry supplements which are not very well signaled that are Chinese propaganda. There's a number of radio stations across the United States that play segments which are directly taken from China Radio International, now rebranded, I think, as Voice of China. So there's a way in which these sorts of influence operations are starting to be noticed by US lawmakers at the same time as things like the Confucius Institutes and so on have been increasingly sort of noted and targeted by.
But arguably in the same way as, you know, Voice of America broadcasts or seeks to broadcast in all over the world. I'm not sure if it's actually on the air in China or not, if it can manage to do so. The BBC tries to do the same and espousing British values all over the world.
Absolutely, and you know, with growing economic power, often comes growing political might, and you know, these things sort of go hand in hand. But I do think there's a need for some recognition of the extent to which this, by contrast, say to the BBC, is directly editorially controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And while it may contain serious reporting, it's still very tightly constrained, and the message is one that reflects Chinese power in the world.
A good point indeed. Sam Gill, we'll be hearing more from you later as you wrap up, give your review, I should say, of the Asian front pages. But for the moment, you're listening to the Monocle Daily. Up next, we'll be asking if the crisis around Brett Kavanaugh be bringing President Trump and the GOP closer together.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
p.m. in Washington, D.C. We're going to turn to the U.S. now, where the confirmation process for Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee has been anything but uneventful. Brett Kavanaugh's nomination has been thrown into turmoil by an allegation of sexual assault from his teenage years and offered a real test of whether the president can actually work with the Republican members of Congress. Well, I'm joined now by Ryan Williams, who is the Senior Vice President of Communications at FP1 Strategies. He was also Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign spokesman. Welcome to the program, Ryan. Not often that we talk about a president from one party trying to work with other elected representatives from that party. Why is this particular moment being seen as a test?
Well, Supreme Court nominees are extremely important. They come around not very often. And this nominee in particular has the ability to perhaps change the balance of the court. Brett Kavanaugh is a conservative justice. He's got a strong record. He's replacing Anthony Kennedy, a justice who was seen as a swing vote on the court. So this pick has really big implications. It could move the court to the right, and that's something that Republicans in the White House and in Congress and across the party would like to see, a court that strictly interprets the Constitution rather than an activist judge in that place.
But while certain Republicans were willing to thumb their nose at President Trump over health care reform, you know, you would argue it shouldn't be too tricky to get Republican lawmakers to get behind a conservative appointee to the Supreme Court.
Yes. I mean, there's general consensus amongst all Republicans that Brett Kavanaugh is a very qualified nominee for the court. He's received a qualified rating from the American Bar Association, which is a left-leaning organization. He's someone who's been in the been in office as a judge for a period of time and was previously involved in Republican politics, serving as a prosecutor in the Clinton matter in the 1990s under Ken Starr, and also as a lawyer and the White House staff secretary under President Bush. So he's not some Trump person that just came on the scene in recent years. He's someone who has a long history. He's well-respected in Washington, and it was a pick that really brought Republicans together for President Trump.
And when it comes to the nature of the allegation that has emerged against him of a sexual assault from when he was 17 and the accuser was 15, and forgive me for saying, I think if the party roles were reversed, it might be harder to get a liberal appointee with this kind of sexual allegation hanging over him or her past a Democrat majority. It shouldn't be as much of an impediment, one might argue, with a Republican majority.
Look, I think that, you know, when the allegations came out Sunday, many people in the party said, let's take a step back here and let's vet the allegations, bring them before Congress. So we did see a delay in the vote. We've now seen over the last several days the accuser's lawyer say she will testify publicly. Now she's saying, well, she won't unless there's an FBI investigation, despite the fact that the FBI has investigated Judge Kavanaugh six times in the past. And I think many Republicans are beginning to see that this perhaps is there are games being played in terms of trying to drag out the process. That doesn't detract from her allegations, but the proper forum for that is before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, and that's what Republicans want to see, and that may not happen. And if it doesn't happen, I think we're going to see this nomination move forward.
Is it fair to expect it to happen when you consider the nature of the allegations and the fact that, you know, this woman has gone on to become a psychology professor, but to suddenly, you know, inhabit the spotlight in this way? Is it fair to expect that?
I think it's fair for someone who's accused like Judge Kavanaugh to have the ability to confront these allegations. It's also fair if this woman feels this way and says this happened, and she obviously is coming forward and being public about it.
But it's one thing to make the allegation in a court of law, a local court perhaps, where there mightn't be that much interest. It's quite another thing to do it under the full glare of the world's media, which would be watching her if she were to testify.
Well, that's the if you're trying to attempt to influence this process, which she seems to be doing. She seems to want to say something about Brett Kavanaugh and his qualifications for office, as she said in the Washington Post interview. The appropriate forum for that is the United States Senate. That is where that is the audience which decides who becomes the next Supreme Court justice. So if she does want to make these statements and try to have an impact on the process, the proper place to do it is under oath before the United States Senate. And the Senate has given her the option. She does not have to do this publicly. They can do it in closed session without any cameras around. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, has given her four options. They can fly staff out to California, where she lives, the other side of the country, interview her there. They're trying to be accommodating to her, and they're trying to find a way for her to tell her story, which she has a right to do. But the proper venue for this is the United States Senate, because that is the body that considers Judge Kavanaugh's qualifications for office and makes the call as to whether or not he will be the next Supreme Court justice.
Ryan, what's your analysis as to the likelihood of Kavanaugh actually getting this nomination? Is this a bump in the road or a real obstacle?
I think it remains to be seen. I think the allegations are very serious. And I think that by delaying the vote and setting this hearing for Monday, if she shows up to the hearing, whether it's public or private, and makes her case, I think we're going to have to see. If she follows through on her threat or her lawyer's threat to boycott the hearing if there isn't a further FBI action, I think this nomination will move forward. It really comes down to two senators, two swing senators for the vote before the entire body. Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. They're swing votes. They can go either way. Susan Collins came out today and said it would be very unfair if she did not come before the committee. And her comments on this today indicate that she probably will vote for him if she doesn't appear. And that's all you need. You need 50 votes to pass her pass him because the vice president would cast the tie-breaking vote. And if you get Collins, presumably all the other Republicans vote with him, and, you know, Murkowski's a question mark. The votes would seem to be there if she's on board with Kavanaugh.
Ryan Williams there, we'll have to leave it. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Daily. Here are some of the other stories that we're following today. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has agreed to shut down one of his country's main missile testing and launch sites. It follows a marathon meeting with South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. The agreement was described by Kim as a leap forward towards military peace on the peninsula. The chief executive of Danske Bank, Thomas Borgen, has resigned. It follows a money laundering scandal involving the bank's Estonian operation. He stepped down following an investigation into payments of around 200 billion euros through its Estonian branch. And the Australian airline Qantas will place an order next year for planes capable of making a non-stop 20-hour flight between London and Sydney. The airline's chief executive, Alan Joyce, has revealed he's in advanced discussions with both main playmakers, Airbus and Boeing. This is the Monocle Daily. Well, time now to indulge in some modern obsessions. Sustainability, design and technology. They have become fairly ubiquitous buzzwords. But finding a company that meaningfully brings them together certainly isn't easy. Well, to keep the conversation on design futures moving forward productively, Kohler Kitchen and Bathrooms has partnered with Monocle to run a series of events under the theme All Things Connected. Launched in August with an event in Singapore, the programme takes in cities around the world, from London to Toronto and Dubai and Bangkok. The second event takes place tonight here in London. But before this evening's panel discussion, Monocle's Daniel Bache sat down with Kohler's Global Director of New Product Development, Mark Bickerstaff, to hear about the thinking behind the events and to talk about how Kohler puts technology, design and sustainability at the heart of what they do.
I think connectivity has incredible potential to add value to the way we lead our lives, not just in terms of pleasure, but also in efficient use of resources and energy and smart ways to really have livable cities for the future.
It's a big part of what Kohler is trying to do, I think, in sustainability in design. Is that part of what you're hoping to discuss?
Absolutely, absolutely. That connection is key to us in that we have an ethos that everybody who's in our business abides by our values, and they include very much sustainability, net zero goals, actually net positive goals are coming through. And we really believe that everybody has to start thinking that way at the beginning of the process. When we look at life cycle, we know that the biggest impact we can have on sustainability is working in the development phase, the product development phase. 80% of the impact is, if you like, designed in at that point. So education and challenge that we give to our designers and our engineers at the earliest possible stage is really critical.
I guess when you're looking to be sustainable in the long run, sort of the grassroots, the base of that, the design, that's such a big part of moving forward, is it?
Absolutely. We know that the days of consumption without care are gone. We believe in, you know, our CEO David Kohler very much sets out the mission that everything we do has to be more environmentally friendly, that everything we do has to move us forward, and we need to leave the world a better place. And that's not idle talk for us. You know, we're a classic American corporate. We're driven by how we're doing. We manage against the numbers that we achieve, and that includes everything to do with sustainability.
I guess, you know, so many consumers these days demand a sustainable product, sustainable company, and that's a big part of building a brand, I guess, as well, but also in how companies are set up. They want to be sustainable. They want to have impact as well. How important is it for Kohler to be a leader on that side?
It's very important, and it connects to the very grassroots of it, which is you can't employ the best people unless you are actively progressing in that area. People are coming out of education, coming out of colleges with a very strong grounding in ethical practice. And what we're finding is that unless we really demonstrate that we are progressive in that matter, we don't get the best people. And that connects to that fundamental foundation of our business. If we go back to the, you know, early days of the 20th century, we can see our leaders at that time talking about respect. Respect not just for the people who work with us and work for us, but actually respect for the environment around us, respect for the materials we use, and thinking about that carefully so that we have a sustainable future.
I guess these series of events are a lot about connection and connectivity, bringing different worlds and different thinkers together for the most important thing, the discussion about it. How do you do that at these events? How do you make sure we're having important, impactful conversations?
It's very much about being humble, honestly. You know, it's tempting to think, you know, Cola Company, we're a big brand globally, that this is all about selling. Actually, it's not. Actually, this is about promoting the conversation. And it's about saying we, Cola, and partnering with Monocle, really want the conversation to be had. We think there's value in active discussion with people who are in the field, people who have different perspectives, and that we'll all learn from that. And we'll learn from that. And we'll try and put that into play in our strategies and the products that we then develop.
I know this isn't about selling, as you said, but you talk about some of those products. And I'm so curious about what you have going on in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in the home, when we talk about technology and designing better products.
You know, we're in the age when everything's connected. You know, all things connected, that's the title of the event. And that's sort of the start. You know, I think every company around the world that's endeavoring in this space has put connectivity into products with an open mindset, because we don't know really what is possible once you connect products. What we are doing is exploring the possible, imagining the possible, and really exploring ways that we can connect things for the value to the user, to the environment. So the products we're developing and we're showing are products that have connectivity to enable control, to enable efficiency, but also really focused on creating the next level of experiential delight, you know, and that's really the key. And I'd say the thing we're learning now is that classically thinking about the product in isolation is no longer enough. And it's no longer enough just thinking it's a product that's connected to the internet and that's enough. It's a product that's connected to the environment around it, to the room, to the architecture, and to the journey that the person experiencing it takes to it, from it, and in between. And it's those in-between moments that are just as important as the moments that you're actually using the products.
So if we go back and talk a little bit about sustainability, say, or consumption, can you give me a concrete example of something in the home then and how it would be connected and how we can learn about how our house works or how our consumption is going?
I mean, it's the classic things about sensing where you are in your home simply allows you to track movement and then, for instance, adjust lighting, heating, as you move around your home. So you become much more efficient in where you put the heat, where you put the light, based on the patterns of usage. Okay, that's immediate energy saving. In the bathroom, we know that by more precise control and by sensing behavior, we can, for instance, just use the right amount of water rather than a huge amount of water. You know, we've gone from the days where we were using 20, 30 liters of water to flush a toilet. Now we can use technology to sense how much water you need and reduce that right down to 2 liters. And actually, we're looking even lower than that. So it's really meaningful gains in terms of resource saving. And especially when you think about urban densification, the challenge of making livable cities, the challenge of having lots of people in small spaces, how we apportion resources, how we stay on top of usage, how we optimize it is absolutely vital if cities are to remain in any way sustainable and livable.
I guess the underlining theme of all this is we can do it with great design as well. It can look good, it can feel good, and can be quite livable. But you've also, for these panels, brought in big architects and designers that are outside of the home as well, and maybe even outside of Kohler's main world, but I mean, people in the hotel world as well.
Yeah, we're looking for diverse opinion. You know, we very much recognize we're part of the built environment, but what we do is internal architecture, but it touches on how people live their lives. And every architect, whether they're doing city planning, whether they're doing rural environments, has a perspective on that and has a perspective on the future. Now, a big part of our job in all creative disciplines associated with this is to envision the future. And what we want to do is hear different people's points of view, have that diverse point of view, and understand how we can make it better, you know, and that's the simple mission, really. We talk about gracious living, you know, I see a real parallel there to the quality of life that we hear a lot of talk about at Monocle. And for us, gracious living is just every product we do should be better. Otherwise, there should be no point in doing it. We strive for every product to improve the quality of life of the people who work with our products or our services, you know, more and more with service organization. So our focus really is on gaining the intellectual perspective of great thinkers so that we can be the best company we can be.
Kohler's Mark Bickerstaff there. And the next installment in Kohler and Monocle's All Things Connected series will take place in Toronto on the 12th of October. Still to come on the Monocle Daily, we'll have a look at the day's Asia papers, so stay tuned. Well, it's time now for a tall story, a feature by the team behind The Urbanist. Konstantin Melnikov is a maverick figure in the history of Soviet architecture. Best known perhaps for his series of avant-garde garages and workers' clubs, his most significant building was the house he built for himself in 1929. Just off the main tourist street in Moscow, it is a building both modernist and classical, consisting of two interlocking cylinders and pierced with some 60 windows. Exceptionally for Soviet as well as modern Russia, it remained in the possession of the Melnikov family for decades until in 2014, after much legal wrangling, it was taken over by the Moscow Museum of Architecture. Well, Monocle's Alexei Korolev brings us this tall story.
Konstantin Melnikov never fit in with the Soviet system. A defiant individualist, an orthodox believer, and a homeowner in the age of collective living, how could he? As a result, his career, like the Russian revolutionary avant-garde movement as a whole, was extremely short-lived. By the end of the 1930s, as radical architectural modernism gave way to Stalinist monumentalism, Melnikov had become irrelevant.
Дальше ему не дали.
He was banned from the practice of his profession and had to eke out an existence as a stove maker.
That's Melnikov's granddaughter, Yekaterina Karinskaya. We'll hear more from her later. Despite being ostracized and condemned to penury, Melnikov was untouched by the Stalinist purges. Some say this was because of his role in designing the Lenin mausoleum on Red Square. But without a proper job, he struggled to maintain his family home. Even so, it outlasted both Melnikov and the regime that stamped out his genius.
There are many buildings around us. You see them, you go away, you forget about them, yeah. Right? But not about this house. Believe me, whether you like it or not, you will never forget the forms, you will never forget their image.
This is Pavel Kuznetsov, director of the Melnikov House Museum.
Well, собственно говоря, basically you are inside the museum already because only this IKEA hanger and these chairs and these rugs are from us. But the rest? In 1972, when Cartier-Bresson visited this place and made a sort of photo session here, we have few prints signed by Bresson. And more or less, you see, it's even on the background, everything is the same. You know, try to keep things basically untouched. So, But
Melnikov himself, he had a tragic life, didn't he? Because he fell out with the authorities and then...
Yes, it's time, it's time to say a few words about it. Because in the 20s, his career was really up, skyrocket, right? This period was really short. Actually, it ended at the beginning of 30s already. Till, let's say, 60s. Because he was not rehabilitated after Stalin's death, as many. And only a resignation of Khrushchev in 64. In 65, he was rehabilitated. And last 10 years of his life, he enjoyed public acceptance and pilgrims like you. Came here from Russia, from abroad. It was a place full of legends and myths about old men from the 20s who lived here, a very... separate from other world. You are in the heart of Moscow, in the center of capital of socialist country. I mean, speaking about 20th century. But you are alone here. And this house was, even in Soviet realities, in the realities of Soviet economy, it was some unusual beast. It was considered by neighbors and by local authorities also. Not like a normal house, but some unknown flying object.
И вот это я на самокате в 49-м году в очках с ранцем. Это вообще...
Екатерина Каринская was born and raised at the family home and remembers this special atmosphere well.
...метровых там комнатах по несколько человек. И это мне очень...
Just imagine. I lived in a mansion at that time when entire families had to live in small cramped rooms. That was difficult for me. I really wanted to be like everybody else, but then I quickly realized how lucky I was.
Но потом расхотелось, кстати.
Екатерина continued to live in the house intermittently until 2014. That year, following a long legal battle over its status, she was forcefully evicted by the Moscow Museum of Architecture. That was the last straw that killed the spirit of the place, she says.
И когда произошел этот захват дома, и в него пришли оккупанты из шедевра мировой архитектуры.
When these occupants came, they turned the house from an architectural masterpiece into a mass-market product. This house had incredible energy, a life of its own. Today, it's like a dead person. I'm not allowed inside anymore, but whenever I pass it, I feel like it stands in a graveyard.
Безумно жалко.
The Melnikov House story highlights a wider problem in Moscow. Why is it that some historic buildings are saved, while others, including some of Melnikov's own, are left to rot? I put this question to Pavel Kuznetsov.
Yes, this is true, and we should understand that this architecture, not everything might be a museum like this house. Not everything might be preserved with the same accuracy, with the same details as previously. For architecture, and it's not a story not only about Melnikov, but about all Soviet avant-garde, it's a matter of survival of these buildings, their adaptation to current life, to nowadays needs. Of course, it will be more, in many cases, it would be a reconstruction. But it's possible. In our case, with this house, our situation is much easier. The work done by architect for us. We don't plan to make any cosmetic surgery, but we need to check periodically the health of this building to identify potential dangers, risks, and to prevent them.
For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And thank you, Alexei, for that. Remember to tune in tomorrow at 1900 hours London time when the full edition of The Urbanist comes out. In a moment, we'll have the morning's newspapers from Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The time in Beijing is 5:42 in the morning. It's 22:42 here in London. Time for a check on the Asian front pages now. I'm joined once again by Sam Gill, executive editor at China Dialogue and also an associate fellow at Chatham House. Welcome back to the programme, Sam. Where are you taking us first?
So looking at the Global Times, the sort of state-run tabloid, rather nationalist-leaning paper, there's an update on a sort of bubbling saga the last few days around a case of a Chinese tourist and his parents reportedly being thrown out of the Generator Hostel in Stockholm by police. It was a story that sort of went viral on Chinese social media. There's initially quite disturbing sort of video footage of a young Chinese man and his elderly parents being chucked out in the street and kind of yelling. They claimed that they were manhandled by Swedish police and then rather mysteriously driven to a cemetery outside of Stockholm and left there. The story then became complicated. The Swedish media started pushing back. More footage came out that didn't make it look quite as sort of sinister as that initially sounded. A lot of Chinese netizens, social media users started responding, saying, actually, you know, we're not so sure about this. But one person who really didn't accept this is the Swedish ambassador, the Chinese ambassador to Sweden, a guy called Gui Song Yeo, who's really gone on the offensive and has been escalating this case very very forcefully.
But what's the context to all this? I mean, why would a young fella, a young Chinese tourist and his parents, I think you said, be kicked out of a hostel in Sweden? What are the Chinese asserting, or those who are asserting anything?
Yeah, the specific case is that he had apparently arrived at midnight, and they weren't actually due to check in until the next morning and wanted to stay in the lobby. And the hostel had said, no, you can't actually stay in the lobby.
But are they saying this is political?
Well, they've made out that this is a case of sort of brutal treatment of the Chinese, and that this is evidence of some wider sort of criminality. It's not clear. I mean, it is clear that there's a political subtext to this. I don't know whether the claim is that Sweden is particularly taking something out on the Chinese. I do think that there is a political context, however, in that the Dalai Lama very recently visited Sweden, and I think this forms a context to why the Chinese ambassador to Sweden might be in the mood to go on the offensive and escalate a perceived sort of hurt against the Chinese people, when there was also this perceived hurt over the Dalai Lama. Plus, there are other slightly more long-standing tensions over, for example, the apparently forced confession of a Swedish citizen, Gui Minhai, who was one of the Hong Kong booksellers who was detained and taken to the Chinese mainland. So this forms a context in which Sweden-China relations are probably not at their best.
Okay, let's push on to the South China Morning Post, which has an interesting piece you picked out for us about Germany considering an investment fund to rival China's buying up of overseas tech firms.
Yeah, well, I guess sort of following on EU-China relations and a different sort of tack, this is Germany moving to counter a surge of bids for key technologies in German companies. There's quite a long-standing sort of pattern of acquisitions of high-tech German firms. A lot of Chinese firms, many of them state-owned, are particularly interested in German companies with specialized know-how. They'll sort of buy up small startups in new technologies and effectively transfer the technology to large sort of government-controlled corporations. And there's been some sort of concern lately over the takeover of a robotics firm called KUKA by a Chinese company in 2016, and a stake in Daimler, the automaker, by the Chinese carmaker Geely. The response from the German government that they're apparently considering is creating a billion euro fund to rescue firms that were in financial trouble and are facing a potential buyout. There's also proposals to change the way that government reviews of foreign acquisitions of stakes in companies.
A billion euro probably won't go that far when it comes to some of these acquisitions, you might think. Interesting, though, it kind of very much echoes a worldwide theme of suspicion of Chinese, particularly tech firms. And I'm thinking of the recent clampdown, I think it was in Australia, over Huawei, Chinese telecoms equipment manufacturer, who actually have a modem in my house, so goodness knows what they're looking at, if anything at all.
Yeah, well, that and also ZTE, both of them, you know, major private companies, but sort of seen to have strong Chinese government or military links, and coming under suspicion, but also being very widely adopted by, you know, as the backbone of critical infrastructure in many Western countries, including our own.
Let's talk about a potential diplomatic misstep by Beijing. China-Venezuela ties take a positive step, the Global Times says, just as the rest of the world tries to put Nicolas Maduro at farther arm's length.
It's just interesting to get the sort of take from the Global Times on something that seems unusual when you first look at it, which is not really mentioned in the take from the Global Times. But of course, China just extended a $5 billion loan to Venezuela at a time when you would think that their chance of repaying that would be pretty slim.
Is it a loan?
Well, this is the question, and this is what the Global Times seeks to clarify in your misunderstandings you might have about China-Venezuela ties. It says what needs to be clarified is that You know, some say by developing relations with Venezuela, China is playing a geopolitical game in Latin America, in the so-called US backyard. Well, it says the China-Venezuela relationship is part of China's cooperation across the world with equality and mutual benefits. Beijing will not manipulate any nation as a tool against any other country. It does not want to become a geopolitical player. It wants to take a different path in international relations. So there's sort of pushback claiming that, you know, I mean, it is a moment in which China can point to the rather, you know, shocking allegation in Bob Woodward's book that Trump, you know, seriously countenanced assassinating Maduro quite recently, and sort of say, look, we are a force for stability in the world rather than sort of disruption.
But even in a cynic's mind, is it really in China's interest to support Maduro? I mean, I can't certainly see any advantage in it.
No, I think it gives the lie to the idea that Chinese strategy is always, you know, hugely sort of long-term thinking, five chess moves ahead, five-dimensional chess. The truth is, I think there's a number of different competing interests and solidarities and incentives, and some of them are probably quite misaligned that would lead China to extend such large loans and essentially to extend the regime life of Maduro.
Finally and briefly, Sam, let's talk about an endangered wood. I've not heard of an endangered wood before.
Well, rosewood is very popular among China's wealthy. And
certainly heard of rosewood.
Yeah,
it was endangered.
Well, it is endangered, and it's more trafficked than ivory and rhino horn combined. There's enormous demand for it from sort of Chinese nouveau riche, and it's leading to very widespread deforestation in Southeast Asia. Having depleted a lot in Southeast Asia, increasingly Latin America and West Africa. So apparently about 40 to 50% of rosewood timber in the Chinese market is now from West Africa. A lot of this is illegally traded. And this piece in Inkstone News, which is a sort of imprint of the South China Morning Post, is essentially asking whether Chinese consumers might turn away from expensive endangered rosewood in the way that they have quite admirably with regard to shark's fin soup and other products that used to be very popular at official banquets and so on, and are now effectively sort of stigmatized because of their endangered quality.
The difference being, though, although still endangered, it's a tree and not an animal, and... Yeah,
it is a significant difference. But nevertheless, with sort of a climate of official austerity, anti-corruption and so on, people might start taking note.
OK, Sam Gill there, we'll have to leave it. Thank you very much for joining us today. Well, finally tonight, is American political extremism the produce of the love affair with Hollywood? Well, that is the argument of the film critic Peter Bisking. In The Sky is Falling, Bisking explains how vampires, zombies, androids and superheroes in some ways paved the way to President Donald Trump. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Peter earlier today.
Culture is important, you know, more important than it's ever been given credit for. And there are many examples, you know, the one that springs to mind is Birth of a Nation in 1915, which is said to have revived the Ku Klux Klan. And the thesis of the book is that mainstream culture, centrist culture, pluralist culture, which basically ruled the roost in America since World War II through the Obama administration, has collapsed and been replaced by what I call extreme culture, comprised of the extreme left and the extreme right. And if you see, you know, hundreds of TV shows and movies that feature vigilante violence and disregard for the law or the rule of law, then Trump comes as no surprise. And it's, you know, I think that those kinds of shows have certainly helped to pave the way for somebody like Trump.
You mentioned the vigilantes, and perhaps superheroes are in a way vigilantes. And we saw in the last decade or two, you know, the success of Marvel films and other superhero films. Do you think that's also one of the main components of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there are vigilantes on the left and vigilantes on the right, you know, and far left and right agree with each other on a lot of things. It's sometimes hard to tell them apart. I mean, they both attack the center, the government and government agencies. And so on the left, I think you have the Marvel heroes. And the reason I say they're on the left is because they grew out of World War II and the fight against fascism. And the main villains in these pieces are a secret society called Hydra, which was started by the Waffen SS in the early days of World War II. And it penetrates every agency of government and every, you know, the Senate, the president, everyone's compromised. And the heroes of these movies, let's say the Avengers, are treated by the government as the villains. And on the right, you have something like the Dark Knight's trilogy, where Batman is essentially a vigilante hero who, although he ostensibly fights supervillains like the, menagerie of crazies, you know, the Joker and the Penguin and all those things, in many ways he's as bad as they are. And there's one scene in one of the Dark Knight movies where the Joker says something like, "Boy, you've killed five people. Even I admire that." I think on both ends of the political spectrum, superheroes manifest extremism one way or another.
In another chapter of the book, you mention other type of films, films that, you know, that in a way portray alien life. You know, even films like Avatar, for example. What do those films mean for you? Is it in a form of escapism, or just saying, you know, the way it is on Earth, we can't live like this anymore?
Well, I mean, all these films are escapism on some level, but a lot of them, you know, have ideologies that deliver political messages which are often invisible. And Avatar, actually, they're pretty much on the surface, because the bad guys in the film are the company which exploits other planets for its natural resources. You know, it's basically engaged in imperialism. And the U.S. Marines uses to enforce its will and defeat whatever, you know, life forms there are on these planets that it's exploiting. And this was a film made at a time that there were still American GIs fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. So to make American Marines as villains and the ostensible bad guys, the 10-foot blue humanoids that inhabited this moon which they're exploiting, the heroes, or the victims, who eventually turned the tables on the Americans, is crawling very far out on a limb politically, and the film was attacked vehemently by the right-wing press. And not only that, the American hero, the human hero of the film, abandons, fuses with an alien at the end of the movie and betrays not only his country, but his species. So that's pretty far out there.
Peter, who do you think is winning this kind of culture war? You know, more, you know, the right or the left in that way? Because it's clearly not the center.
At any given time, I think there are several different ideologies sort of fighting each other for supremacy. And it's complicated because some films try to appeal to the left and the right. You know, in other words, if you've invested $250 million in a movie, you don't want to alienate a third of your audience by, you know, essentially pushing a particular political agenda. So films like the Hunger Games, for example, are claimed both by the left and the right, you know, and there are left and right wing elements in The Dark Knight as well. So it's hard to say, also because, you know, people aren't necessarily alert to the ideological messages these films carry. But I think you'd have to say if the left is winning. Although, again, you know, there are very popular films on the right, like and TV shows like 24 and the Christopher Nolan films, Deadpool. You know, in the center, you have films, you know, shows like Game of Thrones, which I think, you know, occupies a middle position. And, you know, so it's hard to say at any given time who's winning. I think it's almost impossible.
Peter, do you foresee an end for this polarization and a return for the more kind of centrist, you know, culture products, being either films or TV?
Well, I think, you know, in one ways, yes. I mean, I think the extreme culture is provoking a kind of backlash in the center, you know, and you're seeing films, even films that start like extremist films like Black Panther, end up with a centrist message. At the end of Black Panther, you know, all throughout the film, T'Challa, who's the hero, the king of Wakanda, is a Wakanda firster, like Trump, in a way. He doesn't want to share the riches of this country with all the poor countries surrounding it. But by the end of the film, in the tail credits, after people are actually leaving their seats and walking, some people are walking out, he makes a centrist appeal to the United Nations, saying we're all one tribe. And we should be building bridges, not walls, which is, an essence and a centrist appeal. So But, you know, in a way, centrist culture had its limitations. And I don't really want to see a return of the center. I'd like to see a return of the center with a leftist bent myself, because centrist culture excluded too much. You know, it excluded the far right and the far left, and then they took their revenge in a way.
Fascinating and a curious theory by Peter Bisking. You can read more about it in his book, The Sky is Falling, How Vampires, Zombies, Androids and Superheroes Made America Great for Extremism. It is out now and published by Alan Lane. Well, that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Monocle Daily. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello and Augustine Macellari, researched by Daphne Carnesis and Martha Libri, and studio managed by Kenya Scarlett. The Globalists will be back here on Monocle 24 in 8 hours' time. Georgina Godwin will be presenting that. And the Monocle Daily is back at the very same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Tighe Enright, and all of the team for the Monocle Daily, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.